Let's go to a city now that's seen its share of crime and poverty and is about to see more hardship. Like so many other cities, Camden, New Jersey is facing a huge budget crisis. The city is set to lay off almost 400 workers tomorrow, including nearly half its police force. Elizabeth Fiedler of member station WHYY reports.
Standing in front of the Camden laundromat he's owned for about 30 years, Carmelo Villegas points to a boarded-up house across the street. It's a drug haven, he says. Villegas says life here will be more dangerous after the layoffs.
It's like I give him a license to these crooks to come in and try to take over.
Villegas steps inside the laundromat where it's warmer. He tells a harrowing story of being shot at by robbers. He says with the city and state strapped for cash, the federal government should step in.
We've been having a lot of wars in here in the United States. That's billions and billions of dollars they spend it. Why they don't spend it here in a country defending our own people here, you know?
There is at least one similarity between the longtime laundromat owner and Camden Police Chief John Scott Thompson. They're both dedicated to this city.
I've spent the last 17 years of my life putting it on the line in this city. Many people I know and love reside in this city, work in this city. I'm married to this city.
As Camden's police chief, Thompson's in charge of preventing the sort of pandemonium many residents predict.
It appears on the layoffs we will lose 163 officers on January 18th, which is approximately 45% of the police department. We are pushing the officers that we have remaining down and out into the field. When it's all said and done, the game plan that we are moving forward with, we will have 92% of the organization in the field. Post-layoff, our street numbers will be 3.5% less than what they currently are today.
Thompson insists the city will not be more dangerous after the layoffs. The president of the Fraternal Order of Police in Camden, John Williamson, has his doubts.
You cannot cover the same amount of ground at the same amount of time with less. You may be able to cover the same amount of ground, but just by the sheer reduction in numbers, the time responses are definitely going to be longer. And if you've been the victim of a crime, you know, exactly how much of a delay is okay.
Camden Mayor Dana Redd says with less money from the state of New Jersey, the city faces a $26.5 million budget gap, and she had little choice but to push forward with the layoffs. But she's still hoping some jobs can be saved.
If we receive meaningful concessions from police and fire, it certainly will lessen the number of layoffs.
25-year-old William Johnson has been a Camden firefighter for almost 5 years. He served in Iraq as a Marine and says if he's laid off, he'll dedicate himself to the Marines and may re-enlist. Sitting in his parents' modest East Camden home where he grew up, Johnson says it's going to be dangerous for the firefighters who are left.
A lot more fires that's going to get started or happen and abandoned places that we were trained to protect. So for whoever's left in the city working, it's going to be very, very dangerous for them.
Johnson's father, William Johnson Sr., says even if the city gets more dangerous after the layoffs, he's not planning to leave.
I'm the block captain out here. You know, we've been trying to keep this section nice and free from a whole bunch of stuff happening to this part of the city.
Johnson Sr. says if things get worse in Camden, it will only make him work harder and speak up louder, because he's not going to let Camden, New Jersey, go downhill. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
This is NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. In schools around the country, the size of classes is growing. Half the districts responding to a recent poll say they're increasing class size because of budget pressures. Many schools fear this will hurt students. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, some education reformers say it doesn't have to.
Marguerite Rosa analyzes school spending for the Gates Foundation. She's been watching districts deal with tight budgets through across-the-board cuts and other desperation moves. Rosa believes schools don't have to view tight spending limits as a lose-lose proposition.
The idea that money has no flexibility, I think, prevents district leaders from making some choices earlier on that would help them in the long run.
Rosa is pushing for adoption of a number of efficiency measures that would help schools even when fatter budgets return. One suggestion is to create a rigorous teacher evaluation system so that schools will know which teachers are most effective. One big benefit, says Rosa, is that would allow districts to increase the size of some classes.
If there's a trade-off between higher teacher quality or smaller class sizes, then we are better off going with higher teacher quality.
Now, research on class size is complicated. There's evidence that smaller classes can help learning, but only if you bring the numbers down below, say, 17 students. That's a number most districts can only dream of. When you already have 25 or 30 kids in a class, there's reason to believe that small increases might not matter. Michelle Rhee is former chancellor of schools for the District of Columbia, and she now heads the advocacy group Students First. She also says that with the right preparation, bigger classes can be an effective way to save money.
The way that I think would make sense is to identify the most highly effective teachers in a particular district and think about assigning a few more students to each of their classrooms.
But representatives for teachers groups say this is all a smokescreen.
If somebody says, I want to raise class size, they're doing it to cut the budget, not because it's actually going to help children.
Randy Weingarten is head of the American Federation of Teachers. Many teachers say it's common sense. Larger classes mean students get less one-on-one attention and teachers have more work. And Weingarten says plenty of parents agree.
Teachers and parents will tell you that the reason they want smaller class sizes is so that they can differentiate instruction.
To deal with the fact that some kids need special help because of learning problems or language differences. Some schools are experimenting with other ways to reduce personnel costs without necessarily raising class sizes. Rocket Ship Education has three charter schools in California. Founder John Danner says his schools save money by putting even the youngest kids into a learning lab for one period a day. There, they get carefully guided computer-based instruction and are supervised by a teacher's aide.
You only need three kindergarten teachers instead of four because the fourth one's in learning lab, so you don't need a teacher for them.
Danner says part of the savings goes into extensive career development for teachers so they can be more effective. Bigger class sizes can be a hard sell to parents, but some education reformers say parents may embrace this idea as preferable to cutting art classes or raising fees. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. A busy week ahead here in Washington as Chinese President Hu Jintao arrives to town for a state visit. And no doubt, questions over America's role in the world and China's will be asked. We spoke about it on the program yesterday, and we pick up that theme today, but with a look back 50 years ago to a speech that still reverberates, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The legacy of the military-industrial complex, that's our cover story today. In a moment, we'll hear how it was received, and later, historian and former Army Colonel Andrew Basevich on whether we've absorbed its lessons. But first, a little background. Eisenhower's speech came after two decades of rapid military industrialization in America, a process that began when nearly 3 million Americans were encouraged to invest billions in war bonds.
You're speaking because your name is on a piece of paper, a war bond. And the enemy listens to you and dies when America speaks.
That money, along with the high taxes of the Roosevelt era, fueled a vast military machine.
We must increase production facilities for everything needed for the Army and Navy for national defense.
An America at war was a prosperous America, and military production had become a cornerstone of the American economy and remained so well after the war ended. But then, in 1957, the process was ratcheted up another notch when Russia launched its Sputnik satellite.
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
Sputnik ended an era of normalcy from 1954 through 57, and Eisenhower was trying to apply the brakes to it.
That's Dwight Eisenhower's grandson, David Eisenhower. He says it was against this backdrop of an increasingly hostile Cold War when his grandfather issued a warning that night, January 17th, 1961.
We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications.
David Eisenhower, we now know that he spent weeks, and perhaps months, on this speech, going through a variety of drafts. He knew that this speech was going to have an impact.
I think he did know it was going to have an impact. In fact, it's one of the greatest speeches. There was a poll of rhetoric professors about speeches delivered by Americans in the 20th century. This speech turns up number 18 on that list. Interestingly, it was delivered within 65 hours of another speech on that list, John Kennedy's inaugural on January 20th, 1961.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
One interesting angle on the Eisenhower farewell is to compare and contrast it with the message that John Kennedy delivers.
Because
on
you would argue that the they're 20th. Not entirely, they don't have entirely different messages.
My argument is they don't. I do see differences in style. I see differences in emphasis. But I would say that the basic topic of both speeches is one and the same. Eisenhower's farewell address in the final analysis is about internal threats posed by vested interests to the democratic process. But above all, it is addressed to citizens and about citizenship.
Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
David Eisenhower, in your book about your grandfather, Dwight Eisenhower, you write that he developed a split personality about this speech, that he would sort of downplay its significance to his old military pals and to business friends, but then he would sort of show a pride in it to others. How do you square that?
Well, there's a lot of buzz, and people acted as though, again, this was something out of the blue. It was certainly not that. That is something that I've established.
And maybe they thought he just sort of, I don't know, had a...
No, I think there are actually two questions here. Number one is the speech true? And what are your allies and or political opponents likely to make of it? And I think the feeling among Eisenhower's allies is that Eisenhower had said something that in one way or another would undermine the position of many political allies that he'd had. For instance, how does this speech relate to the Vietnam War, which is beginning in the 1960s? Has Eisenhower handed anti-war opponents a slogan that they can use to oppose the war? I think that there were misgivings sort of in that vein. Did he speak the truth? That's the beauty of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address. I have immersed myself professionally for many years in the Eisenhower papers. I know how his mind worked. I know what his habits of expression were. This is Dwight Eisenhower in the farewell address, and he speaks the truth.
That's David Eisenhower, grandson of Dwight D. Eisenhower, and director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower. David Eisenhower, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Basevich, a retired Army colonel and a professor of history at Boston University, says Eisenhower's warning came too late.
I think we should view the speech as an admission of failure on the president's part, an acknowledgement that he was unable to curb tendencies that he had recognized from the very outset of his presidency were problematic.
His antidote to the growing military-industrial complex, this term that he coined that night, was a better-informed citizenry. But he was vague about that. I mean, he didn't specifically say, this is how you combat it. Do you think that was a shortcoming of the speech?
I don't. I think in many respects that's the piece that we've overlooked and we've missed. He believed that if there was an antidote, the antidote would have to come from citizens being knowledgeable and engaged and watchful.
Even though you would acknowledge that didn't happen. I mean, in some ways, what Eisenhower warned about has finally caught up with us.
Well, I think so. I mean, one of the reasons that people didn't pay much attention to the farewell address at the time was in the 1950s, a guns and butter recipe seemingly had worked. we were safe and we were prosperous, so what was not to like?
You could build the highways and you could also build the bombers.
Exactly right. In our present circumstance, we can no longer insist upon having both guns and butter, and we are compromising the possibility of sustaining genuine prosperity at home.
You write that there were hints of what was to come in this speech almost 8 years before, in a speech he gave to a group of newspaper editors just after Joseph Stalin died. What did he say there that foreshadowed his farewell address?
Yeah, this is the speech that historians call his Cross of Iron speech. This former five-star general stated categorically that spending on military power, the purchase of weapons, constituted what he described as theft from people.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense of his children, a theft. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities.
And I think that Americans weren't interested really in hearing that message at a particular time. But Americans today, I think, were they to return to that speech, would find that it resonates in the circumstances in which we find ourselves today.
This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Andrew Bacevich, last year, Defense Secretary Robert Gates proposed about $100 billion in cuts to the defense budget over the next 5 years. Is he starting to chip away at some of the military-industrial complex?
I think not. It's not so much cuts to reduce the overall level of defense spending. It's cuts exacted here in order to transfer that money to another defense account.
So how would you even begin to try and carry out what Eisenhower warned against? I mean, I wonder if it can be done.
Well, I'm pessimistic on this, as I am on most matters, because our political institutions demonstrate an unwillingness or an inability to really take on the big questions. And the American people, many of them distracted by all kinds of concerns, like having a job when there's almost 10% unemployment, aren't paying attention. But I think were we to formulate an effective response, it would have to begin by asking the first order questions. There are assumptions about the prerequisites of U.S. national security way overdue for reexamination. Ever since the end of World War II, the United States has been committed to the proposition that maintaining a global military presence is essential to our security. And there was a time, I think, in the Eisenhower era, military presence abroad was useful. To a considerable degree, that's no longer the case. Maintaining U.S. military forces in the so-called Greater Middle East doesn't contribute to stability. It contributes to instability. It increases anti-Americanism. So why persist in the belief that maintaining all these U.S. forces scattered around the globe are necessary and ineffective? If you can challenge that assumption, then I think it becomes possible to ask an additional series of questions that can lead to an argument about a different and more modest national security posture that will be more affordable and still keep the country safe.
That's Andrew Bacevich. He's the author of The Limits of Power. He's also a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Andrew Bacevich, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In recent downturns, Australia's economy has generally outperformed other developed nations. That's due partly to the strength of its commodity exports, from iron ore to cotton. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Brisbane, floods in northeast Australia have hurt production, and that has caused global commodity prices to spike.
As Brisbane dries out from what some locals call the big wet, Australia is tallying the economic losses. Some Australian media have speculated that the damage may be greater than what Hurricane Katrina inflicted on the U.S. economy in 2005. Professor John Rolfe specializes in Australia's resources economy at the University of Central Queensland. He argues that it's not just the total cost of the disaster that matters, but its impact on the larger national economy.
Hurricane Katrina had a very big impact, but I think what is true here is that this shock would be a larger shock to the Australian economy proportionally than Katrina was to the American economy.
The reason is that the state of Queensland has a dominant proportion of some of Australia's most valuable commodities. Many of these are sold to China, whose voracious demand for resources has driven commodity prices up, says Rolf.
Commodity prices are very important to Australia. We are in the fortunate position of having a lot of coal to sell and a lot of iron ore to sell, again because of the China growth, and that's really driving the national economy.
Spot prices for coking coal, which is used to make steel, are up 10% in the past month. They're expected to spike higher while Queensland coal mines are furiously pumping floodwaters out of their pits. Brian Redican, a senior economist at the Macquarie Group in Sydney, says this will take time.
That could take up to 3 months or maybe even longer before those coal mines are ready to go back into production. And, you know, Queensland controls about maybe half of the ocean-going traded coking coal market. So that's a lot of supply that's been removed from the global market at the moment.
Redican notes that other coking coal producers, including Indonesia and the U.S., are profiting from the short supplies.
All those other suppliers that have been playing second fiddle to Queensland in recent years will now really be able to take advantage of those high prices and provide a much more important source of supply into the global market.
The Reuters CRB Index of Commodity Prices is up 29% since last July, the highest level since the global recession began. There's also concern about inflation and food shortages. Australia is a major exporter of agricultural commodities, including wheat, sugar, and cotton. But Tracy Allen, a commodities analyst at Rabobank in Sydney, notes that Queensland does not dominate Australia's production of those crops.
The reductions to cotton production Australia-wide are really at about an 8% sort of level. So it's a very significant downgrade up in Queensland. But when you consider production on a national level, we are still predicting a record crop this year with record production at about 3.95 million bales, I should say.
One upside of the slowdown in Queensland's commodity exports is that the Australian dollar may edge lower in value, and that could give foreign consumers a better deal on, for example, a case of Australian Cabernet Sauvignon or a safari in the outback. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Brisbane.